find some very casually interested in golfing maybe 18 holes a year, and someone else you might find to be an absolute golf fanatic living for the glory of the sport. And other people would say they are interested in gardening, and other people are interested in garage sales. But in some cases they mean a casual interest, and other times they mean that this is basically the central preoccupation of their life. So in the same way, there are many ways of doing church. For some people, church is just a Sunday morning thing. They like to be the people who go to church on Sundays. They might not even like church. They just like being people who go to church on Sunday. I remember years ago when I was getting into running, I ran 2 miles every morning before work just so that I wouldn't get soft and pudgy. And I hated every step of it and wasn't surprised by that. I expected to hate it. Everything I knew about running caused me to hate it, but I wanted to do this thing, and I didn't like it at all, but when I was finished, I was happy to be able to say, you know, to myself, I run a couple miles every morning. I didn't need to like it, I just wanted to do it. And some people approach church the same way. They don't like church, they don't particularly enjoy being at their church, but they want to be able to say they do it. It, you know, feels good when it stops, I guess. So that's church to them. And to other people, church is sort of a focal point of life, maybe not the main focal point, but one of them. If they're thinking of selling the house and moving to another community, and they're sizing up the community, the neighborhood, or the city, whether or not it'd be good to live there, one of the things they look at is what's going on in the churches. Is there a church we could get involved in? A church like perhaps good schools or good opportunities for business or good golf courses is, you know, one of the central issues of life. My sound man's walking around wondering if I'm going to get electrocuted, right? And I'm wondering that too. Okay, good. I was figuring the worst that could happen is I lose the power and I start yelling, but I'd be up to that, and I'm pretty familiar with the notes, so if it goes dark, I think I still know what I want to say. I want to look at what it means to be involved in church. For some people, church is the central preoccupation of their life. They're what some people would say are fanatics about church, and church is the thing. Church is the measure of their life, and if things are going well at the church, then they think things are going well, period, because everything else is immaterial. Well, you know, different approaches to different aspects of life make us different people. But here we are, and what we have in common here this morning is that we do church here. At least we are doing it together this morning. So it would be good for us who are here on a regular basis to come to terms with what we agree together is the standard details of involvement in church. So it's been my intention, and we've been working at this since the end of April. We'll finish up 2 weeks from now when we get to point five, to put together a five-point list of what it means to be involved at West London Alliance in hopes that we can agree together on what it means for us who say we are involved at West London Alliance. And so here's the list. You have it on the sermon outline. We started, first of all, because Sundays are sort of a central activity for us. It's what we do together. So the first item on the list, being involved at West London Alliance Church, is being wholeheartedly here on Sundays. You could get a tape to see what I had to say about that on April 30th. On the back of the tape, you'll see the second part, which is connected to a small group, since a whole lot of the benefits and the responsibilities of church life take place in the small groups. I would make it item number two on the list. What's it mean to be involved? It means to be connected to a small group. And then part three was to be a part of the workforce, because if the church is going to accomplish anything, there's lots of work that needs to be done, and who's going to do it except the people who are involved? This morning we cross a line and get into sort of delicate territory that some of you perhaps would wish I wouldn't talk about, and others would be glad to have me talking about. That is, the fourth part of being involved at West London Alliance Church is being committed financially. And perhaps no one here, but someone somewhere might ask, wait a minute, what's my money got to do with my church life? Someone might ask that question, thinking that, you know, church is spiritual and esoteric and otherworldly, and money is about, you know, down-to-earth, real life. So what's that money got to do with church life? Well, let me give you three answers to that this morning, and so help you see if we can understand God's word together. Help you see what God is calling you to do about your money in regard to your involvement in this or any particular church. We start on a level far more fundamental than your involvement in any particular church. We start with your relationship to God himself. And so the first answer to the question, what's my money got to do with my church life, is this. What we do with our money expresses our commitment to God himself. It expresses our commitment to God himself. Before and above and beyond any commitment to any particular church, what you do with your money expresses your commitment to God himself. Now, what you do with your money always expresses your commitment to something. If you put a whole lot of money into anything, it shows that you're committed to that thing. And here again, we distinguish between people who just are a little bit interested, and some people who are vitally interested, committed to something. If someone in casual conversation tells you that he really likes soccer, you wouldn't know what he means by that. But you know, maybe what he means by that is that when he's changing the channels and it comes down to watching soccer or bowling for dollars, he goes with soccer. Pay no attention to those lights. What I was talking about was bowling and soccer. Some people just, you know, it just what they mean is, yeah, I don't mind watching a game here and there. In fact, I kind of enjoy it. But other people, I mean, find somebody who takes all his disposable income and saves up all his vacations so that every 4 years he can travel to the part of the world where the World Cup is being played. And then he takes his money and pays scalper's prices to get in to watch the soccer games. He would call it football if he loved it that much, wouldn't he? Well, then you know, here's a guy who's a real fan. I mean, his money expresses an intense level of commitment that distinguishes him from other people. Well, what we do with our money, whether it's all for soccer games or all for the mortgage or all for anything, not only expresses our interest in the thing that our money's going to, but because of what God has said in His Word, it also expresses our commitment or lack of commitment to God Himself. And that's because from the very beginning of human history, God has commanded a practice that we refer to as tithing. And the tithe, the word the tithe, means the tenth. So you might just as well call the practice tenthing. But it's been a practice of God's people because it's been a commandment of God from the very beginning to set aside the first 10% of your income as God's money and to see it as God's money and to use it for God's purposes. That's called tithing or tenthing. And I want to show you from the Bible how fundamental it is to our relationship to God. Genesis chapter 14 is the first place where tithing or tenthing is mentioned. And the mention of it shows us the central issue involved in tithing, the central issue behind the idea of putting 10% of your income, the first 10%, to God's work. The central issue is ownership. Tithing is an act of recognizing that God owns you, which is something that God means for us all to see. The story of tithing starts from our records with the life of Abram, who later was known as Abraham. He was raided by a number of small kings. I mean, they weren't small, but the kingdoms were small. They were little local kings. And they took off with a lot of his stuff. So he went and raided them back and experienced this great unlikely victory. This relatively little guy, little political power, Abram, walloped these kings. And it was a stunning victory for the underdog. And on his way home, Genesis chapter 14, verse 18, shows us a mysterious character, Melchizedek. Mysterious in part because he was not only a king, but a priest. And usually those are two different offices, two different people. But here, the king was the priest. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, he was priest of God Most High. And he pronounced a blessing upon Abram, and the blessing stressed one thing, that is God's ownership. He said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High." Abram of God Most High. That means Abram belongs to God. And in case Abram or anyone else misses the point, of all the things Melchizedek could call God, he gives God this title, possessor of heaven and earth, owner of heaven and earth. He says, blessed be Abram who belongs to God, who owns everything. Verse 20, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And here's the illustration or the example of the point that God owns everything. The victory that Abram just experienced, the unlikely victory, was a gift of God. God delivered your enemies into your hand. That victory came from God, is what Melchizedek was sent to say. So this king/priest says, God owns everything, God owns you, God possesses heaven and earth, therefore God owns you, therefore everything comes from God, therefore your victory comes from God, and Abram responds. And see the response, this is the first record of this happening, but it's very early in the records. It says at the end of verse 20, and he, Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, a tenth of all. He gave a tenth of his spoils, a tenth of his income to the king priest who is representing God as a response to the truth that God owns everything. This is a truth that God means to bring us to, an understanding of the truth that God owns everything, including everything about us. So in another mention of tithing very early, we see Abram's grandson, Jacob, in chapter 28, dealing with God or having God deal with him. Now, this is Jacob in the midst of his experiences with God, a very up-and-down kind of story. Jacob was a very down-to-earth person with a real lively story of coming to terms with God's ownership of his life. And there was a particular time in his life where he had a very restless night. partly due to the fact that he chose to use a stone as a pillow. That's never a good idea if you want a good night's sleep. And partly due to the fact that he had this very strange dream, a dream in which he saw a ladder or a staircase stretching from earth all the way to heaven, and angels ascending and descending on the ladder up and down from to and from God. And at the end of this night's sleep, the end of this dream, he takes this rock and he says these words, verse 16 of Genesis 28, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it." And he was afraid, and he said, "How awesome is this place? There's none other. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." So he rose early in the morning. He took the stone that had been a pillow, and he put that he had put under his head, and he set it up as a pillar. So the pillow becomes a pillar, and he poured oil on its top. He set it apart. He anointed it to say that it was a sacred pillar. And he called the name of the place Bethel, which means house of God, though it used to be known as the city of Luz. Then he made a vow. This was a sort of a conditional promise he makes to God. He always was a wheeler dealer. He always was striking bargains and trying to get the better of people. So here he is, true to form, coming to terms with the fact that God has a stake in his life. And so he strikes God a deal. He says, one, if God will be with me. Two, and if he will keep me on this journey that I take. It was a very dangerous journey, and God on his side sounded like a real definite asset. And if he will give me food to eat and garments to wear. Condition number three. And condition number four, and I return to my father's house in safety. Which seemed very unlikely if you consider the nature of his adversity. He says, if those conditions are met, then the Lord will be my God. You know, I'll sign on. I'll acknowledge the fact that God is God, that the Lord is my God. And this stone, which I've set up as a pillar, will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, now he talks directly to God, of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. Which is to say, you meet my conditions, God. Here's a great condescension of God that he's willing to do business with this conniving guy. But God, Jacob says, four conditions, and if you meet the conditions, then, hey, good news, God, I'll recognize you as God, and then as part of the acknowledgement, as part of the recognition, I'll give 10% of everything to you. So tithing is an acknowledgement of the fact that God is your God, that you concede the point, that you acknowledge him as God, and recognize that everything has come from him. Now, recognizing that everything comes from him is the basis upon which we give 10% of our income to him. I'd express my sympathies to those of you who have never heard about tithing before, and for the first time in your life, you're hearing someone suggest that a right relationship to God involves cutting the first 10% of your income from you and cutting it away from you and giving it to religious work. I remember being shocked by that when I first heard of it myself, and if any of you are hearing it for the first time, my condolences. It's a shocking thing. But as you begin to picture it and understand its tie to the ownership of God to your life, I hope you begin to see the rationale of it. Why should God not? Why shouldn't he call for 10% of your income? After all, 100% of your income is a direct or indirect gift of God to you. And that's something God wants us to see. He's got a plan for his people. He means for all of his people to come to the place where they understand that God owns everything about them. This is something that to David was particularly articulate about. You can look with me in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, not a passage specifically on tithing, but this fundamental truth upon which tithing is built is expressed really clearly here. David was not allowed to build the temple that he wanted to build, but his son Solomon was given the privilege of building it. So David was given the auxiliary privilege of accumulating all the materials out of which the temple would be built. So he had this big fund, this big fundraising program, so people would bring all the temple material together. And they were all stunned at what was accumulated. And this is David expressing how surprising it all was to see this huge collection of gifts and wealth brought in to build the temple. David blessed the Lord in the sight of all the assembly, 1 Chronicles 29, verse 10. And David said, "Blessed art thou, O Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever." Now here's what he's, over and over again, he's going to say the same thing in different ways. He's going to say, I've come to see that God owns us. Here's what he says. "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness." That is, find yourself any greatness in the world, experience any greatness, feel anything's great, it's God's. You know, the greatness of the Grand Canyon, the greatness of the ocean, the greatness of the stars in the universe, the greatness of the pyramids, any greatness is thine, O Lord. Thine is the greatness. And not just the greatness, but the power. and the glory and the victory and the majesty, indeed everything that is in the heavens and the earth. Everything belongs to God. He goes on to say, thine is the dominion, or the lordship, the ultimate authority. Thine is the ultimate authority, the dominion, O Lord. And you exalt yourself as head over all. Now, specifically, he says, both riches and honor come from thee. Here he was the king, the most honored person in the kingdom. And here he had all these riches accumulated, and he says, both riches and honor come from thee. And thou dost rule over all. And in thy hand is power and might, and it lies in thy hand to make great and to strengthen everyone. So if you've ever attained any level of honor or greatness or strength, you have God to thank. If you got all your badges and cubs, if you were a Queen Scout, if you were class valedictorian, whatever honor comes to you, it's a gift from God. All honor, all riches, all greatness, all strength, it's come to you from God. Now therefore, he says, our God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name. But he can't get his mind off this huge accumulation of wealth brought in by the people who were going to supply the material for the temple. So he asks the question, but who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? For all things come from thee, and from thy hand we've given thee. For we're sojourners before thee. I mean, we hardly even live here. We're just visiting the planet for a while. We're just staying for a little while. We're tenants, you know, living in rented quarters. We're just here on the earth for a while, as all our fathers were. Our days on the earth are like a shadow. Our great long life is really just a fleeting thing. It's just a shadow. And there's no hope, by which it means no hope beyond any hope that God gives. Oh, Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided to build thee a house for thy holy name, it's from thy hand, and all is thine. Now that's God working his program in David's life, bringing David at the high point of his life to the realization that he means to bring all of his people to, the realization that everything comes from God, that you've never had a good day, you've never had a good moment, you've never had a good thing except what God has given you. It all comes from God. So now when God turns around and says, acknowledge the fact, by always giving back to me the first slice. How big's a slice? It's 10%. The first 10%, excuse me, of everything God gives you, the first 10% you go give back to God in acknowledgement of the fact that the whole 100% came from God. It all belongs to God. And that's what the tithe acknowledges. God is meaning to bring us to the place where on every level we're able to recognize what Paul said to the wise men in Athens when he preached, Acts 17, in God we live and move and have our being. Our life comes from him, our movement comes from him, our very existence comes from him, it all comes from God. We need to recognize that. And we recognize that on a practical level by giving our money to him, the first 10%. So what's my money got to do with my church life? Well, in the first place, what we do with our money expresses our commitment to God himself. That's not all it expresses, but that's the first, most fundamental thing it expresses. So the question comes to all of us, are you using your money for the purposes for which God has given it? You want to be able to say yes to that for fear that he'll decide it's not a good use of his money to give it to you and he stops giving you money. His intention is that you use your money to express your commitment to him. You do that by living off 90%, having given 10% to him. But what does that mean about the local church? Well, what we do with our money expresses more than our commitment to God himself. Point two, it also expresses our commitment to one of God's actual churches, one of God's real-life churches. In the Peanuts cartoon strip, it was my favorite character, Linus, who once said, and this made its way to posters that were hung up in university dorms in Guelph, anyway, I remember. Linus used to say, I love mankind. It's people I can't stand. Which was a real yuck-yuck back in the early 70s, I assure you. That's what he said. I love mankind, it's people I can't stand. And what he said, you know, easy enough to love people theoretically. You can love mankind. You can love humanity. But when you try to get down to earth and love actual people, it can be a real nuisance. In fact, you can find yourself unable to stand even being with real-life people. Well, in the same way, many of us in the spirit of Linus could say, it's easy enough to love the church in theory, but it's real difficult to love any actual church made up of actual human beings with all of their annoyances and funny characteristics and idiosyncrasies and so on. We can be like Linus and stay theoretical in our commitment to God's purposes and commitment to God's church by not getting actually involved in any real-life church with all of its difficulties and difficult people. But God, who calls us into an actual involvement with himself and his people, is actually obviously calling us into a commitment to some particular church. Maybe not this church, but some particular church. And we are dysfunctional in our relationship to God. We're misfits in a way if we can't fit ourselves in any particular church. If we don't fit into some particular church, then we're not actually doing this thing called following Christ. So we need to fit ourselves in. And one of the ways in which we fit ourselves in is to realize that we as committed people are the people obligated to do what needs doing in regard to making the church function. And of course, one of the things that a church requires is money. Some churches require more money than others. Churches that insist on having a building of their own, like we insist, people who like that building air-conditioned in the summer and not air-conditioned in the winter, but rather heated in the winter, have certain financial obligations. And who's gonna meet those financial obligations? Who's gonna pay the hydro bill and pay for the upkeep and the renovation of the heating, ventilation, air-conditioning system, except the people who actually get involved in an actual church? Theoretically minded people, exclusively theoretically minded people, might find themselves too spiritual to bother with any particular church with its actual bills. But that's not a real commitment. That's theory that sort of goes against any actual reality. And we need to do better than that. Churches cost money. Let me step into real delicate territory here and point out from the scriptures that it not only costs money because some churches have buildings, and if they, if they don't, then they have other bills to pay in terms of renting facilities or pitching lean-tos or whatever they would do to find a place to meet from week to week. But churches cost money because in order to do church properly, it's invariably necessary to set a couple of people aside, or one person anyway, and pay him to not go to work, but rather to go and do church work. The Bible's very clear on this idea that the ruling elders, especially the teaching elders, are worthy of an income so that they can devote themselves to the work. The apostles practiced that themselves. They took support from people so that they could do the work of apostleship, and they passed on, as Paul does in 1 Timothy chapter 5, the idea that every church should have people who are working away at the church's expense in the work of the ministry. Here's how it's said, 1 Timothy 5:17 and 18. Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor. That word translated double honor is a word from which we get our word honorarium. It's very much a financially oriented term. Let the elders who rule well be considered of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. So he's saying there's ruling elders, and some of those ruling elders are teaching and preaching elders, and especially the ones who work hard at preaching and teaching are worthy of double honor. That is, they ought to be supported financially. In order to prove that, the Apostle Paul brings forward an Old Testament reference to the proper care of livestock. He says, for the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. So he's saying if it's wrong to muzzle the ox so that he can't help himself to some of the grain while he's busy threshing it for the good of the whole farming community, the whole topic of money just gets me so choked up. Then it's wrong to muzzle the Christian laborer who's working hard at preaching and teaching and therefore isn't able to carry out a full-time job. He requires support. Now, that can be done in the old-fashioned way of just bringing a load of potatoes or a couple of chickens to the back step of the pastor's house. That's how it was done some days in the good old days. Or it can be done in a more formal and regulated way. And generally speaking, regulated is better. Paul the Apostle says everything should be done decently and in order. Therefore, elders who rule well should make some rules about how much the pastors are paid. And the people in submission to the elders should say, all right, well, we need to put that much money together so that there's salaries for the staff and so on. That would be a matter of doing things decently and in order. The scriptures do command all of us to be in submission to and obedience toward those who are our spiritual leaders, since those people keep watch over our souls. In Hebrews 13 it says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. So it's a matter of obedience to your leaders to provide or to create the kind of fund from which the work of the church can be done. You see in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 an illustration of a spiritual authority, in this case an apostle, Paul, giving specific instructions on how the money should be raised, how it should be collected, so that the work of the church can go on. Paul the apostle says to the Corinthians, "On the first day of every week, let each of you put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections may be made when I come." Now that's the directions for the Church of Corinth. It's not directions for the Church of West London Alliance. But the point would be, the spiritual leader, in this case the Apostle Paul, sends word and says, "I'm coming to visit. I don't want collections to be taken while I'm there. So I want the people of the church every week to put aside money the first day of the week as God prospers you, so the money's there when I come." He's giving specific instructions about the money. So it stands to reason as a principle that the church leaders are required to put together a plan, a reasonable plan that has congregational approval and however the congregation's set up to give approval, which the whole church family in their involvement of the church complies with. You obey your leaders, you submit to them, you say, okay, here's the money we've decided needs to be brought in for the work of the church, let's give it. And so we should. It's a matter of obedience to God, and therefore a matter of obedience to His Word and to the spiritual leaders that His Word says are over us. Now, the lively question on this whole notion, tying point two to point one, is whether or not the same thing, whether it's the same amount in both cases, and whether the tithe that God requires is, in fact, what the church is entitled to. Is the local church that you're involved in, West London Alliance Church, for example, entitled to 10% of your income? And you might be surprised and you might be relieved to hear me say, as a matter of personal opinion, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is that any particular church, if it was thoroughly committed to tithing, that means if all the people of the church were tithing, generally speaking, this day and age anyway, that amounts to a much greater amount of money than any particular church needs. It's certainly the case here. And let me just crunch the numbers with you for a minute and speculate with you on this. Anybody can do this kind of arithmetic. It's a matter of fact that this year, the year 2000, the budget that was brought by the elders to the congregation and approved at the annual meeting stands at $380,000. So the elders, in an orderly way, say, we figure we need $380,000 to keep the church functioning. The church approves that. There it is, $380,000. Now, what's the tithing strength of West London Alliance Church? Well, do the math, but there's over 200 households involved in the church, involved being the critical term here. 200 households listed in the church phone book anyway. Take what the average income of a London householder would be. Who knows what that is? Let's go conservative. Say $40,000 is the average household income. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's hard for a household to get by on something less than $40,000. Say it's $40,000. The tithe is $4,000. You got 200 families. What's that? You can do that. That's $800,000. We need $380,000, and we're good for $800,000 if everybody tithed. So the local church doesn't need your whole tithe. It'd be perhaps a fun challenge to know what to do with it if it came in. But the fact of the matter is, the local church can't do all of God's work the way it's set up right now. This is sort of a vicious cycle, because if it had more money, it could do more. But it can't do all the work of the church. So there's parachurch organizations, there's missionary organizations, quite separate from the local church, that could use your support as well. I would say this in regard to the local church's entitlement to your tithe. As a person committed to any particular local church, and a person committed to God and so tithing, the largest portion, the lion's share of your tithe, should go to your local church until all of its goals are met. And if all of its goals are met early in the year, if you count it by years, then the second half of the year's tithe could go to other work. But you owe it to your church as a matter of priority, since you are a member of the church, to see that the church's obligations are met first of all. And this is how we work. So in February at the annual meeting, the amount is agreed upon. It's $380,000 this year. And every month we publish how the income is lining up with the budget. And you might remember these numbers. At the end of March this year, we published the fact that we were about $3,000 behind in our giving to date. That's kind of a cause for alarm. So those of us who are committed to the church say, ooh, that's not very good. And if we've been sloppy in our giving, we step it up a bit. By the end of April, reduce that deficit to, or that shortfall to $200 from $3,200. So everybody breathes a sigh of relief and says, hey, we're pretty well on the money. And that was a glorious thing, because meanwhile, in a decent and orderly way, we're accumulating money for the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning renovation, right? All part of the work of the church. Well, by the end of May, we're back to $2,000 shortfall on the budget, so we get concerned again. But we track it year by year. We track it month by month and make sure, this is the church family's way of making sure that we as a church family collectively are meeting the obligations that we've agreed on as a church. And by doing so, we keep up the work of the church and the work of the church goes forward. And then by doing so, we express our commitment to that particular church. The spiritual principle upon which this idea is founded comes in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6. Jesus says very clearly, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And you can understand that in a couple of different ways. You understand that where your treasure is an indication of where your heart is, because you wouldn't have given your treasure to it if your heart wasn't in it already. So if you are committed to the church, then you won't ignore its financial challenges and obligations. You'll give money to it just because your heart's in it. But it works in the other way as well. It's not only a thermometer of your heart's interest, but it's a thermostat as well. As you put your money into it, you get a heart for it in ways you didn't have before. This is true on every level, about anything that you give your money to. If you give a lot of money to a particular thing, you end up loving it more than you did before. You ever notice that? I mean, some of us got real fond of those clunker cars we drove as our first beater old cars, and they cost us a ton of money to keep up. But the more money you put into it, the more fond you get of it. Maybe the analogy doesn't work for some of you. Well, think about teenagers in the house, and the more money they cost you, the more affectionate you feel towards them. Maybe that analogy doesn't work either. Well, the point would be where your treasure is, generally speaking, your heart is also. And if your treasure is in your local church, that is, if a large proportion of your tithe is going to your church, then you have an investment in that, which keeps you caring about your church. And of course, the church needs us all to care about it. If everybody sort of falls into this state of complacency and lethargy where you hardly care, and then the church goes off the rails and starts to get weird in one way or the other, and nobody really cares because no one's heart is in it, then the church is free to wander and disintegrate. You see that happening in some churches that are going right off the rails theologically, or right off the rails spiritually, or right off into some wacky aspect of possibility, and nobody really cares because nobody really cares, because nobody really has any investment in it, because their heart's not in it. But if the people are faithfully obeying God and funding the work of the church and their hearts are in it, then when the church goes a little bit astray, I mean, there's an appropriate hue and cry and alarm. Wait a minute. You can't let that happen to this church. I've invested heavily in this church. So where your heart is, your treasure is, your treasure keeps your heart there, and that's as should be. For as people who mean to be real in our commitments to God, not just theoretical, not just like Linus, you know, loving the church but hating our particular actual church, we need to keep our commitment actual, and our money is one of the ways in which we do that. Back in April, starting the series, I talked about the need we have to adjust our attitudes if necessary so that we can be wholeheartedly here on Sundays. It's just tough to do church if you can't be wholeheartedly here when we gather together. Well, our money, our giving of our money, keeps us wholeheartedly here hour by hour all year long. And our commitment needs to go beyond wholehearted attendance and participation on Sundays. It needs to be a real life commitment, and it's our giving of our money as well as our time, which would be part of small group and workforce, that keeps our hearts attached to our particular church as God calls us to be truly committed. Now let me move on in our concluding minutes, and I'm happy to do this because we move on to point three and cross a line from discussing financial obligations to discussing financial privilege. For it's a great privilege to invest in the work of the kingdom, as it's a privilege to invest in any kind of winning proposition. No fun at all to invest in something that's dying, but it's great privilege and a lot of fun to invest in something that's a winning proposition. And there's no idea, there's no concept, there's nothing going on in the world that is more a winning thing than the work of God in the world, which He has promised to succeed in, and which He has explained the success of from the first of the Bible to the conclusion. Right in the middle of the Bible, book of Isaiah, here's God talking about His campaign, what He's doing in the world, which helps us to understand what we can invest in that is of importance and significance. Here's God talking about His plan. Isaiah 45, 22. He says, "Turn to Me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there's no other. I've sworn by Myself, the word has gone forth from My mouth in righteousness and won't turn back, that to Me," here's His plan, "every knee will bow, to Me every knee will bow, every tongue will swear allegiance, and they will say of Me, only in the Lord are righteousness and strength." God says, men will come to him, and all who are angry at him shall be put to shame. Isaiah says, men will come to God, and all who are angry at God shall be put to shame. That's God's agenda. That's what God's doing in the world. So we work away at our private projects, and we work away at our hobbies, and we work away at our obligations. But when we give money to the kingdom of God, whether to a local church to which we're attached, or to other kingdom work going on in the world today, we are directly investing in that which we know will be successful and significant for all of eternity. And one day we'll stand before the judgment seat of God and we'll have our lives reviewed. And we'll look back on some things that took a ton of time. And perhaps we'll look back and say, I can't understand why I gave so much time and energy to that particular thing. Not in the case of every commitment, but in case of some, we'll say, I don't know why I did that. But then we'll look at the time and the energy and the money we put into the kingdom of God, into the project of bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ and the good news of the lordship of Christ to the world, and we'll say, I'm so glad I did that. Was it ever good that I did that? Because there I was touching eternity. There I was investing in that which will last forever. Now, Paul takes these very words, every knee, every tongue, and he writes them to the church of Philippi when he talks about how one day every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, and every knee will bow to him. And he shows that God's plan to bring about the knowledge of God in every place is entirely tied to the mission of preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. Bringing people to God is a matter of bringing them to allegiance to Christ, confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord. So the work that we put into Christian missionary work, whether it's the work of a particular church or the work of missions around the world, the work of a particular Christian organization, is all work that entitles us, that privileges us to be involved in the one thing which we know will count for eternity. So it's not just with a sense of obligation that I call you to understand your financial commitments and the implications of church involvement here at West London Alliance Church, but it's also with this exciting sense of privilege. We are being invited into a project which has nothing short of eternal ramifications and eternal rewards for all those who would be so wise as to invest. Jesus talked about laying up treasures in heaven moths and rusts, they won't touch it. That's the point. And that therefore is the one worthwhile investment that God allows us to make of our money. What's it mean to be involved at West London Alliance Church? In part, it means to be committed financially for all the reasons which God so graciously has revealed to us in his word. Let's pray together.